So let me introduce myself. I'm Mark Schoenfeld from Münster, Germany, and I'm speaking about security aspects in bytecode engineering, especially in the language Java. So what brought me to this topic? Well, I was always wondering why Java is so damn slow. So I started to look a little bit deeper in this nice language, in the underlying architecture. So let's have a first look in the agenda. We're talking about a Java security architecture, give an overview, then have a look in the JVM, the bytecode basics, then we look what we can do with it, do some engineering, some re-engineering, reverse engineering, all this stuff, and built on that are some applications that use these techniques. So, given a short overview of a Java security architecture, well, who can better describe a language than a judge or a finding of a judge? So, this judge made the following, summarized the following things about Java. It's a language which developers can write applications with. Second, there is a set of programs within Java that expose APIs on which developers in Java can rely. These programs are called Java class libraries. Third element is the Java compiler. The Java compiler translates all these codes into the Java bytecode. And someone has to execute all these bytecodes. That's the JVM. And the JVM translates again these instructions to instructions that can be used by the underlying processor, by the underlying processor, not the operating system. Okay. So that's the architectural stack. We have the hardware, which can be whatever. We have the operating system, Linux or Win32 or what's else, also Solaris, also from Sun. And on top of that, we have the Java virtual machine, and the Java virtual machine serves as execution slave for J2E application servers or for browser JREs or for standalone JREs. For example, Java Web Start, and on top of the J2E application servers, there are the enterprise Java Beans, or the servlets, JSPs. On top of the browser JRE, there are the applets, and on top of the standalone JRE, there are the standalone applications, all written in Java. So what will be our point of interest today? That's the Java Virtual Machine, Java Virtual Machine and its language. So what's the view of the developer? We have source code written in Java or written in some other language that can be translated to Java class files or written in Java bytecode, which is translated by some assembler. So all this is loaded via class loader, then it is verified, and after it's verified, it's getting direct into the JVM and is executed. So this is also done for system classes. System classes go via system class loader and the verifier into the JVM. So there are some things that don't belong into Java bytecode engineering that are the Java security RPEs. So the security manager or the signed code bases or the principle-based access control, JACE, or the cryptography that don't belong here. I'll speak about JVM securities in terms of class loaders, class file verification, or JVM intrinsic security features. So, the Java Security API, the Security Manager, is point of access control as far as code is concerned, defines policies to auto domain resources, Security Manager objects instance enforce policies throwing security exceptions. So if you don't have a Java Security Manager, it's a good idea to use one because you don't know if some code is doing something bad. But this is still Java Security. Java Security lets you do some fine-grained control to limit access on socket connections, thread groups, dynamic library loading for JNI, for native libraries, calls to C routines. So to file access can also be limited, or access to external shared resources, for example, print jobs or clipboard. The program control can also be controlled by limiting access to exit buttons or top-level windows or whatever nice GUI features there are, and to runtime components, the members, the packages, and the class loaders. Oops. Yes. Okay. Java Security is also, as mentioned, code-based authentication. You can store your class files in jars and get them hashed, and if the signed hash is broken, the jar is broken, you can use username and password for authentication and stuff. But let's skip this here. Let's go to JVM Security. JVM Security, what does it mean? The Sun guys introduced a non-continuous memory model with distinct data areas. It has stack frames where the execution actually finds place. And we have the static method area where the bytecode is stored. Then we have the objects, the garbage collected heap, which is automatically managed by the JVM to allocate memory for our objects. Our objects can be casted, type safe casted, not like in C or C++. We always have to assure that the type is right. And we have no self-modifying code once it is loaded into the JVM until JVM 1.4. We have automatic garbage collecting, which disallows explicit double free operations, which can also be very dangerous. We have automatic array bounce checking, which prevents off by one and buffer overflow scenarios. So what are class loaders? Class loaders load a class as byte array into the JVM. They can load from files, they can load from the network, or if you generated a class file via generated byte array, like from the BCLL library from Apache. Or you can even compile on the fly. If you have Java source files, the class loader can go and compile it if the class file is not there. So there can be a lot of intelligence be in a class loader. So the class loader establishes namespaces. You can't just bypass security APIs. You can bypass the libraries. So if it sees it's a system library, it goes to its parent class loader, which all the class loaders are formed in trees. So if it can't find its code, it goes to the parent and tells him to load the class. So the verifier has to check the loaded class file for integrity. This is a four-step process. The first step has to check for structural correctness. Second has to check for data type correctness. The third has to do bytecode checks. And the fourth, which is not actually done by the verifier, it's achieved during runtime. It checks the symbolical references. So a lot of, yeah, there's some lazy checking in Java bytecode verification. So this is a short, this is a small reduction, yeah, how to call it, small summarize of the last three slides. So let's go a little bit deeper in the verification process. Step one does basic structural checks. The class loader gives a verifier a byte array. So first has to look if it's has a right magic value, Caffe Babe. Is the version number correct? Does it fit to my JVM? So you have to check the major and the minor number, if it's okay. All the attributes need in proper length. The class file must not be truncated or have extra length, it's extra bytes at the end. And the constant pool must be in the right format and must not contain superficially unrecognizable information. This is a cite from the spec. So the next step is to check for content, for constant pool information. The final classes are not subclassed and all final methods are not overwritten. So you don't change functionality that is not intended to be changed. All classes must have a superclass except the Big Papa class, the Java lang object. So you have to check the constraints for constant pool entries. For example, class references in the constant pool, they all have to be a name, and that name has to be found also in the constant pool. This also has to be done for all fields and all for methods. They must have legal names and must have a type signature, and this type signature has to be correct. So after we have these structural and have passed the first two steps, we have to go into bytecode verification. This is the core part of the verification, and there are first static constraints. We have to check maximal local variable count throughout the control flow. We have to check control flow correctness. So does our code always start at the byte one? Does it not branch beyond the end of code? Does it not jump into the middle of another instruction? That all has to be checked. Are all exception handlers? Exceptions are a very important part of Java. Are they valid? Do they overlap? And if they overlap, do they have partial overlap, which is not allowed? So if this happens, the bytecode has to be rejected. So there are structural constraints. Are all subroutines in the scope? Are all exception handlers usable? And is the data flow in a good shape? So, sorry, a little bit nervous and always hit the wrong keys here. Oops. So now we have the step four. The step four is done in the JVM during runtime, and the JVM verifies that the currently executing class is allowed to reference a given class. So does it really exist? Or is it allowed to use it? And if not, you get a runtime exception. So are all these signatures okay? Does it have a real name? And if this is all okay, the JVM goes and inserts some quick instructions, some optimized code into the bytecode. But you as a programmer don't see these quick optimized instructions. You can't use it in own bytecode sets. So there are some problems with the JDK verifier. It's not enabled by default sometimes. So this nice example shows that we have a class, and a class illegal access 2, and it has a public value, the trade secret, in a string, and it has a function test which is intended to print. And we have a second class which uses illegal access 2 and is initiated. Then the printout routine is started, and then the value str is altered, and the test routine is called again. No, then the value is printed out, and this is okay because str is a public value. If we change this to a private value, we have some problems with these direct calls to the member str. The member str should be restricted, but and the JVM should somehow complain, but it doesn't. It doesn't if you compile just illegal access again. It only complains if you issue this special verify flag, and then you get a little error message, and it says what's actually wrong. And I would expect to be the verify flag to be on all the time, but that's not the case. Yeah? The private, no. If it doesn't have a prefix, a modifier, then you can use it. So actually this should complain, and it doesn't complain all the time. So another problem is the inner class stuff. And the inner class, you have to see that we have an outer class, and this outer class also has a private value. The private value is secret, and it's special access function alter secret, and we have an access function which gives a reverse of this value, and we have an inner class. And this inner class accesses all these two private elements of the outer class. So how can this be achieved in bytecode? And in bytecode, now I can show you this in the bytecode directly. Okay, we are back now. Let's have a look in the outer class. And the outer class has some added functions, and the added functions are some synthetic functions. Whoops, let's have a look. And these synthetic functions can't be called from outside. Let's have a look. So we see there's a function which is called access $000. Just this is automatically added to the outer class and can be used to bypass the private access to the value secret. And there's also a special value somewhere for the reverse secret function. So we can access this field from other Java classes via Java code, but we can access this field to use by using some Java bytecode calls and call the outer class access $000, or we call the outer class access $100. So we can use an access and bypass the intended private behavior of this variable. So, oops, let's have a look if we can see it somewhere better. So here we see it a little bit better. We have these two methods added to our class, which we don't know of, which is done by the compiler, and which can be used to read and access this special value. Sorry. There were some other problems with the Java bytecode verifier, which caused trouble in the Netscape Navigator some days ago, where an unsigned applet could be exploited and got rights it wasn't intended to get. So there were a lot of problems with these kind of type checking. So what can be done? What can I do to check my code, to check code which I get from other people, if it's really a good code? We can use some third-party products like the Justice verifier from the BCLL project. So I can demonstrate this one. This value via Java class. Okay. Let's go further. So I have these. So are there some other problems with Java security? So Java, once the JVMS started, has you can do memory allocation and thread activation. And maybe someone has seen these funny CPU usage applets, which run and take all the power of your computer while just showing a gray screen. This has not been solved. So this can use to lead to denial of service problems on the client side, and then you have some problems with the machine. So what are the internals? The internals of the JVM. The JVM is an abstract concept. Sun has implemented just the interface, and the implementation depends on the OS there's a responsible vendor, and there's a vendor Sun or the vendor IBM. On Linux, you have the Blackdown JDK, which is available until the current version is 1.3. The other both are at 1.4. So there's a Java bytecode. The Java bytecode is independent from the internal, from the CPU type. It's stack oriented, it's object oriented, and it's type safe. Just a short reminder from what we've heard before. So again, let's have a little deeper view into the JVM. We have the method area, we have the heap where the objects are stored. We have the current state of execution, the PC registers. We have the stack frames, and we have some method stacks for the native calls, to the underlying, or if you have Java interfaces to products, third-party products like MQSeries, they have native a JNI interface to their libraries, to their native libraries. So what is a frame? A frame saves the runtime state of execution threads, therefore holds information for method execution. We have program, and the program counter uses these frames, and all frames in the stacks, in a stack, in a thread are managed in a stack frame. We have the method area, which stores the runtime information of the class file. We have the type information in it. We have the constant pool. We have the method information and the fields. We have the static fields of a class. We have the reference to the class loader of the class, also the guy who loaded this class. And we have for Java reflection an anchor to the reflection information. So we have the constant pool, and the constant pool, well, it's the biggest part of a class file. The constant pool holds all these strings and references, and everything is almost a string in a Java class file. Field name or method name, references, they are small numeric values. They are constant string values, all are in the class file. They make about 60% of a class file. The actual code is about 10 to 20% of a class file. So actually, if you move all the strings out via resource bundles, you get smaller class files, and this makes it all a little bit faster to load. So the constant pool is used for holding all this verbose information. So this is the structure, the header, the constant pool, the interfaces, which are implemented by our class. We have the access flags, and we have the attributes, and we can use class dumper programs like JavaP or dump class from the Oolong toolkit, and this can be used to show the internal structure of classes. So this we've heard before. This is also the types. The types of fields and methods are called signatures. The fields and methods, they have initial values, and methods have, of course, the code attribute, which holds the Java bytecode for executing this method, for running it. The code attribute also has more information, so how many stack space do I allocate, how many local bars do I use, what kind of bytecode, or what is the actual bytecode. It's also stored in a byte array. And we have the table of exception handlers, and the exception handlers are called when an exception occurs, and that is another important part of the class file. So let's go to step 3, the bytecode basics. There are some types, JVM types have prefixes, B for byte and short for, there's an S and integer. And you can see that the JVM is specially designed for integer values because most of the instructions are mapped for integer values. And for example, Booleans are completely omitted from the type system. They have to be emulated by ints. Long characters, single floats, double floats, and references. They are prefixed by with an A to classes, interfaces, and arrays. As mentioned, they are used in opcodes to signal the intended type of the operation. So what types of instructions do we have? We have, well, it's a stack-oriented language. We have the shuffling operations. We have calculating operations. We have conversions, D2I, double to int, integer to byte, or double to float, or whatever. Local storage operations, which are used for, for the local variables. We have array operations to allocate Java arrays, to allocate new arrays. We have object management, field management, field access classes, field access functions. We have push operations, which actually put a value on the stack. We have control flow, and we have threading. And in control flow, we see the nice instruction, no operation. We have go to, jump to subroutine, return, table switch. We have a look at this later. So bytecode, there are some rules for bytecode. Bytecodes are followed by 0 or 1 more bytes of additional operand information. This is nothing new. And we have some table lookup instructions. They have flexible lengths. We have special operations for large class, for large constant pools. And if they are in the, if the index can't be accessed by a single byte, we have to wider these operations via a large instruction. So we have no self-modifying code, and we have no branching to arbitrary locations, just to the beginning of instructions and inside of the current method. And this is, of course, enforced by the verifier. So how can this be used for bytecode engineering? So we can think of obfuscators to manipulate informations that can be used for reverse engineering. We can use native compilers to protect our bytecode to make it run a little bit faster. Or we can build our own bytecode with programmatic generations, access functions for JDBC or whatever, or manipulate class files with an API, for example, the BCL. So obfuscators, what do they do? They do some nice name mangling. The JVM does not need useful names for methods and fields. This is just for readability. So they can be renamed to single letter identifiers or some underscore or whatever names. The constant pool names can be mangled, or we can have some manipulation of our control flow and insert some phantom variables or do some stack scrambling. And by relying on the default values, these ghost branch instructions never execute, and the decompilers don't recognize this and have some problems with this. But there can also be some problems with this obfuscation. we always, if you have some functions in it that deobfuscate the names, this has an impact of your runtime. And if you have dynamic class loading, if you have a class which is called account, and the obfuscated class is not more called account, so you have a problem if it's called B16 or whatever. And obfuscation also breaks patterns that can be used by JIT just-in-time engines for optimizations. So if you have stack scrambling or whatever, it is not optimized in the right way. Can't be optimized if it's not known to this JIT engine. So protecting the source code. Source code can also be protected by converting it to a language, to a compilable language like C, which has the advantage of fast execution, additional decompilation effort, but there's long turnaround times for developers and even small Java programs. They produce large executable files. I used it with TowerJ for a small program, and it produced 67 megabytes of source. That was not nice. Took 45 minutes to compile. And the transport program may be vulnerable to C. Special vulnerabilities like buffer overflows and off by ones if the TowerJ or whatever translator code is not checked or protected against this. So we have seen the engineering side, now we see the reverse engineering side. Decompilation, we can retrieve source code from class files, we can do graphical analysis, or we can do disassembly. Yeah. Decompilers, which one are available? There's just small selection of them, historical selection. There has been the Mocha from the late Jan-Peter van Vliet, or the Yasmin, which was a patch of Mocha, and this crashed less often. There's a nice decompiler, and the decompiler is JD, JET, which is not written in Java, this is written in C++, and this is fast and quite usable, but can also be fooled by some stack scrambling. There are some nice graphical user interfaces for it, but you can also use it on the command line. Okay, so what's the general method of decompilation? You rebuild the control flow from class file code segments. You're matching these flow patterns to Java language constructs. You associate the constant and external references from the constant pool entries. And then you rebuild the source. Of course, if you have mangled names, these mangled names also, and if these are condensed in the constant pools, you can't undo these name, these combination of the names. So you can also do graphical analysis. This graphical analysis has to be so basics for it can't be seen. You have the chance yesterday to see the basics by Halva. Halva showed how graphical analysis can be done. So actually the idea is just repeated in some short words. Whoops. You walk through the specific code and you retrieve the target instructions and you calculate the control blocks, you calculate the successor relationships, and you rebuild the control flow. And what I've done is to export the control flow as some graphical definition language and display this graphical meta file in graphical applications like AC. Well, I can demonstrate this, but we can skip this and maybe show that later. So you can also do disassembling with Java P. Java P we have seen, or you can use a disassembler like the bug fixes. So this is now quite usable, this product. It comes with a good dump class tool which shows you all the internals of class files. So how can your own bytecode be built? You can learn from the experts and have some look what Java C and other compilers generate. Then you use Java P to have a look inside these class files. And then you see how high language constructs can be transferred to bytecode. Or you can use the old 64 way and you do binary patching and add some knob codes for branches or disable or alter minor functionality via with the knowledge of the opcodes to the binary code and alter it to your favorite way. Or you use the assembler or the disassembler, and only one usable product, and this is the assembler from book programming for the JBA. Maybe there are some other available, but I haven't seen these by now, if they have. And then there's always the questions, does it have the same functionality? And I haven't seen that by now. Or there's another possibility, you use a special library like the BCLL from Jakarta Apache. It comes with several tools, and it gives you the opportunity to alter your class files via an API, to insert instructions, to modify instructions, to have a visitor pattern over a class file. I will show you the effects after the presentation. So binary patching in detail, you can read the output of Java P or a dump class tool. And if you know the opcodes, you can find some injection point, and you can blank out some unwanted code with knobs or adjust some binary checks. So if you have a branch which depends on non-equal, you can disable this with special pop from the stack, because you have a value on the stack which you have to get rid of, and you have to blank out the other two bytes by 00 nop nop to continue the control flow. And the pop was used to keep the right balance on the stack, because this is enforced by the verifier. So if you have this bytecode, we have this simple class, and if we compile this simple class, we have this bytecode. We see that there are some constants, but first it starts with this, let me better show this in the file. So we have our three values which are stored in a string array. So we have to first allocate the string array, we have to push a 3 on the stack, then we have to issue this a new array instruction, And this new array instruction has to be dumped on the stack to be usable for the next instruction. And then we push the index for the constant viva. Then we store it in the array. Then we know we have the reference to the array on the stack, so we have to dupe it again for the next instruction. And we use the next index, and we do that for all three values. So now we go into the loop. We have our constant zero, which is the initialization for the local variable two, which is stored there. Then we make a branch to our check if we first have to increment our running variable, and then we see if this running variable is exceeding the array length of our array. And if so, we are done, and if not, if the two values on the stack, the array length and our running variable, if it's false, it goes back to line number 25. So this is a basic behavior of this bytecode. So what does a constructor do? The constructor of this viva object, public viva string A, so the gets a string value. The string value is put into variable 1, and on variable 0 we have the this pointer. And the this pointer is used to do the initialization for an object, which is a precondition for a valid object. And after this is done, we can work with the object and do our initializations. So because we are in the constructor, and this constructor is always called bracket init bracket. And after we are done, our object is now initialized as an object. We can get a print stream, and put it to a local variable and invoke the uppercase function for this variable, and then the return value is pushed on the stack, and after this is pushed on the stack, it's printed via the well-known println function. So, and then the functionality is complete, and we do a return. So this is a basic translation of the small Java program. So we have seen this. So what do obfuscator do? What do they do in detail? Now we know some bytecode basics, so we can see how this can be used for obfuscation. So on the right side, this is a little bit better to see. On the right side, we have the original code. We have these constants which are pushed into the array. We have the constructor here. And now we see on the left side what is actually done by an obfuscator. The obfuscator inserts two phantom variables, A and B, for example, and takes the value of B, which is zero because it's initialized by its default value, stores it into local variable 3. So there it's stored and it's zero. And then later in the control flow, it's retrieved by an iload 3 and it's compared to zero. And if it's zero, it goes to an instruction, which is here, and this equals to the go-to, which is in the original code. And this code is just to fool the decompiler, because the decompiler doesn't look at the default values and has some problems to interpret this. So let's have a look at the constants. The constants are a little bit mangled. So if you decompile it, we have these strange literals. And after each loading from the constant pool, the obfuscated code has a call to a special routine, and this routine, of course, has an impact on performance, takes a byte array, do some calculations, and returns the original values and puts them on the stack. So we see here, here, and here, we have extra code which costs extra money, especially if we run it on IBM 390. So let's continue here. So what can also be done, only be done in JBC? We can use special functions, and these special functions in Java functions also have to, they cannot differ only in the return type. If they differ in the return type, it's not obvious for the compiler which function to use. In Java bytecode, the signature is a little bit extended, because the Java bytecode always, in Java bytecode, you always also see the return type. So if we have this overload function, which basically does nothing more than pushing a nice value on the stack, the first one pushes a 1 on the stack, the second one pushes a 1 as a double value on the stack, and if we call this, and this first looks nothing special, but if we use a decompiler on it, so let's try this now. Therefore, overload J, which is a assembler source code. Well, it's here a little bit altered to put almost P on the stack. And if I now compile it, I have a class file. Oops. And this class file now can be executed, of course. So it works. It's a valid Java program, which is not, there's no complaint from the verifier, even if we switch on the verify flag. So this also works. Now we start our decompiler. Whoops, overload class. We already have it here, but just to be sure, if we now use C inside the source, generated source. Oops. We see that the decompiler has some problems to identify the real method, to identify which of these both methods is really used. So you can use this as a special technique for decompilation, for decompilation protection, to achieve ambiguous names which are not really ambiguous because you know the bytecode. So let's go ahead. Of course, if you again compile this, Java. Overload Java. Well, you get an error because this is already defined. So you have a source, you have a bytecode, and the bytecode, if you decompile it, is not recompilable. This is quite nice for information protection. Well, the description, the following, the signatures are considered doubled in Java, but they are valid in Java bytecode, and therefore, because they extended through the return type and can be used in obfuscation techniques by you. So scenarios in where we can use this stuff. We can use bytecode for database access. We can generate access classes for JDBC or Java data objects or whatever. We can add without changing the source code. We can add logging or profiling facilities. We can have a look at the domain boundaries and add in filtering functionality for content control. We can find bugs in the JVM implementation, which might be useful for DOS attacks. Or like Jython, we can port our own language to Java bytecode. Just have to port our language to this stack-oriented presentation, and then we have our own language ported to or runnable on any Java platform. So Java library holds, JNI applications, checking for null pointers is often giving too little regard. A lot of routines in the core Java runtime classes use native code. Yeah, it's in the JVM DLL or the lib JVMSO, and not every entry into these trusted libs is shielded appropriately. And in some cases, you can force a JVM crash when you pump zero values, null values to that routines. So here's a small example that I submitted to Sun 9 months ago. You walk through the libraries. Yeah, to find these bugs, you traverse through the runtime libraries, and then you detect the public classes, and in these public classes, you detect the public methods, and from it, you can filter the native methods, and then you have a list, and on this list, you can DAO one by one, and then you have entry points to the JVM. Yeah, let's run this tool, run on the JVM 131, and we will see that we get some hits. Let's have a look at the source code of the native finder first. Oops. So what does it do? Well, this is just file selection. This is file selection. Well, actually, it takes a jar file, and then it runs the BCLL class parser. Then you have a interpreted class file, and then you can see you have some methods. And with all methods, you can have a look if these methods are native, if they are public. And if they are native and public, you have the methods you want. And if they are also static, you don't have much effort to call them. I will now start the native finder to JDK 1314, the latest for the version 131. Well, I think it's here, JIE lib. RTJAR. Well, let's first grab the statics. Well, this is not on the path. When I go a little bit upwards. Ah, here it is. So now I have a list on all my functions on all native entry points. And here, for example, I take this one. And this is, well, now also known by Sun that this crashes the JVM even in 1.4. This is a official library call, causes a JVM crash. So let's look at the source code, which then can be used. So where is it here? Static crashes are here. So now I can build upon the definition of this function, build a call to the JVM, and I run this with a, start this with a null value, and then I try to execute it. So we get a nice JVM crash, and there are three more of them in JDK. Well, this is actually JDK 1.4. But this hasn't changed since JDK. I now explicitly call JVM 1.3, Java 1.3 access controller. So, referring quality control in JVMs, nothing has changed since 1.3.1.2.1.4.0. So if someone from Sun is here, maybe we can speak about five more of them. This is actually dangerous if you have control passes in your applications which lead to such statements. So it's very dangerous. Well, it's also, I also tried this on my local Linux, but this is on VMware and it's a little bit slow, so I can show you this by this dump. This not only affects Win32, it also affects Linux, and it also tested it also on AIX. They have some problems with this function. And this function is not new, it's old, and it's so easy to find and still in the JVM, not to believe. So well, we had this list, the list with the static methods. We have seen they're easier to test. The list is much larger if you also use the dynamic functions, the dynamic methods, the object methods which use an instance of a type. If you have a default constructor, well, you can find it's easier in the hard way. You have to look at the class hierarchy to instantiate an object of this type. Yeah, and if you call this method with null value, you can test your JNI implementation for these type of errors. And Sun hasn't done that. Well, we've seen the demo. Well, we have finished now for JDK 1.3.1, the greatest, the biggest type of vulnerability in JDK 1.3.1. And 1.4.0.5 promises, promises some more stuff, because in JVM 1.4 You can hot swap your classes via debugger interface. And then someone with access to your JVM can insert some classes to your JVM via the JVMDI, which is open via sockets or whatever. And this has to be activated at the runtime, at starting point of the JVM. So once the JVM is started, it's open to this problem, to this hot swap facility. And then with a special defined, special handcrafted JVMDI call, you can substitute class definitions by modified code in running applications through the debugger, or someone who pretends who is a debugger. Yeah, so far, this is how Java can be analyzed for security problems. Java security in terms of maturity and stability, especially of the official APIs. Oh, so, if you have questions, feel free to ask them now, or maybe some email, and you get the tools, or visit our website. And in September, we will be ready with our new design, and then we have all the tools also online, and you can have a look a little bit deeper into the details of Java security. Yeah, any questions? If there are none, thank you.